Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of The Robots Are Coming. And today we will be interviewing Professor Emily Underwood, Associate Clinical Professor of Law at Helford, Director of the Innovation Clinic at the University of Chicago Law School. I'm Ken Hinn, your host with The Robots Are Coming. So let's get started.
Hey, Ken, thanks for having me. And I don't remember if we've ever talked about this before, but Berkeley has a special place in my heart because my mom went there and we used to go visit the campus all the time when I was growing up. So good to be here with another Berkeley fan.
Yeah, go Bears.
So thanks for the introduction. And before we start, I did want to say, I know a lot of your listeners, and I didn't know this when I started law school, probably don't know what a law clinic is and don't really have a sense of what I do all day. So let me first start by kind of explaining that a little bit. So as a clinical professor, I'm actually still actively practicing law. So while I do teach a podium class that's like a traditional law school class, the students who enroll in that class spend the majority of their time doing real legal work for real clients under my supervision, and that's really what they're getting course credit for. All law schools across the country have a variety of different clinics. At the University of Chicago, we have 14 or 15 different ones that all do very different things. My clinic in particular is focused on representing high-growth startups and venture capital firms, and we do transactional and regulatory matters. And I know you and I will talk a little bit about more about that in detail later. And then, as you mentioned, in addition to my role at the law school, I also sit on the advisory committee of the George Shultz Innovation Fund at the university. That's a multi-million-dollar fund established out of the university's endowment that invests in early-stage companies that are commercializing university intellectual property in deep tech fields. So think physics, biotech, materials sciences, and the like. So my role at the university is a ton of fun. I get to be both a lawyer and an investor, and I get to represent, mentor, and diligence companies as well as mentor students. So I've been worked in every industry under the sun. So excited to talk to you about technology today.
Yeah, and I'm definitely excited to talk to you more about that as well. And I also want to say that you are a professor at among the best and most prestigious law schools in the world, the University of Chicago Law School. And as you mentioned, you're a big part of the effort to identify the innovative ventures coming out of the UChicago ecosystem. What are some of the current innovations and startups that are really happening in the Midwest?
Yeah, so I think it's a really exciting time to be part of the innovation ecosystem in the Midwest specifically. And we can talk a little bit about some things, some particular technologies that we're seeing from the university in the Midwest in a minute. But when you think about the things that a startup really needs in order to be successful, I think the Midwest has all the pieces of that puzzle. The number one thing that you often hear people talk about, to your point about the University of Chicago being here, is you need talent. You need really smart people who either can innovate or can facilitate innovation by other people. And we have tons of great schools here in the Midwest that are churning out graduates that can do all of those things. We have an ever-increasing number, at least here in the city of Chicago, and I know across the Midwest as well, of public and privately funded ventures that are creating more resources for founders. So in the Chicago, we have places like 1871, the Polsky Center here at the University of Chicago, M-Hub for more materials sciences companies. My friend Troy Vossler founded Generator up in Wisconsin, which is the biggest accelerator there. And I think they've been incredibly successful at stoking the innovation flames up in Wisconsin. And I know other states have similar initiatives going on as well. One of the knocks, I think, of being a founder in the Midwest has historically been that you can't get funding here because there isn't enough capital. And that the capital that is available here has traditionally been a little bit stingy on terms, especially when you compare it to the capital that's coming out of Silicon Valley. And I think over especially the last several years, the Midwest and investors in the Midwest have made a concentrated effort to make sure that that's less true. And so what we're seeing now, depending on what metric you use, this number might be different, but there's been almost a 10x increase in the amount of VC funding that's actually coming into the Midwest. Additionally, I think Chicago and the Midwest have done a really good job of picking their battles. Probably it's unrealistic to expect that, the city of Chicago or the Midwest whatever overtakes Silicon Valley in terms of computing, classical computing, and that sort of thing. And so we've really honed in our focus on specific industries where we think that we have a competitive advantage. So I think a lot of exciting things happening in the Midwest around quantum, around healthcare services, transportation logistics, and things like that. And I think that's really smart. I think you see Raleigh and Boston having kind of done something similar where they focus a lot on life sciences. And so I think that that's a smart move by the Midwest. So as a Chicago native, obviously, I think a lot of founders feel this way too, a little bit concerned about the budget crisis in Illinois, obviously the pension crisis and financial woes. But leaving that aside, I think the Midwest and what's happening with entrepreneurship here in the Midwest, it's a really exciting time.
Yeah, and it sounds really exciting because you really are on the forefront of tech, law, and business. And I really love what you're doing because you're shaping the future leaders in the space. And I heard that you also counsel startups and venture capital firms and regulatory matters at the Innovation Clinic. As someone who oversees a lot of different startups at the University of Chicago and beyond, how do you envision the future of technology, particularly in what you mentioned earlier in AI, life sciences, quantum tech, and even law?
Yeah, future of technology, big question, right? And it's a big question because technology, what technology is, can mean so many different things to so many different people, right? So even colloquially, when you read the news today and you hear people talk about big tech, they tend to be talking about Twitter and Amazon and household names like that. But tech can be a lot more granular, a lot more deep tech, a lot more different from that. So based specifically on my experience at University of Chicago, my sense is that the hottest tech spaces, at least in the immediate future, are likely going to be quantum computing and biotech. With respect to quantum computing, it's a really exciting time. And we here at the University of Chicago have a specific accelerator that's designed specifically for quantum computing companies, whether hardware or software. And this is the bleeding edge of this kind of field. Quantum computers will have 10 times more processing power than classical computers. And when you see how that industry is developing, it really feels a lot like you're back in the 1980s when classical computers first got off the ground. And so it's really hard not to be excited about the actual impact that quantum computers, once they are readily available and the technology is there, the impact that they will have on our lives. It's also a really exciting time to be in that industry from a venture perspective because it's really a foot race right now to see which type of quantum computers and then which companies within each type of quantum computer will win the race to 100, 1,000, even a million qubits of processing power. And so what we're seeing is any dollar that can help those companies reach certain milestones, even a week, a month, sooner than their competitors, really is making a huge difference. And so given how, you know, you see a lot of other industries where you can pour a lot of money into something and it won't accelerate the timeline because the timeline sort of is what it is. I think that's decidedly not true in quantum. And so the more money that's being poured into it, the faster it can happen. Those practical quantum speed ups are what everyone's chasing. And so I think, you know, while we're in that stage where a lot more money really matters, we're going to continue to see that industry pull a lot of focus for venture capital.
Yeah. And you also mentioned earlier about the growth of the biotech industry in the Midwest. Could you delve a little bit more into that, Professor?
Yeah, definitely. So that's another area that I in particular am really excited about. And I think we can think of this as kind of the modernization of medical care. When you think about the kinds of things that you use in your daily life now, as compared to, well, you're so young, you probably don't remember a time when this was the case. But when I was, I feel old saying that, but when I was in high school and college, there was really no such thing as kind of personalized anything. And now we're living in an era where everything is hyper personalized to us, right? Our social media algorithms show us the things that are most directly relevant to us. If you go on Spotify today, I just learned that if you type in upside down into Spotify, it will create a playlist for you that says, if you were taken by Vecna in Stranger Things, what would the playlist be that you'd have to play, right? And so we live in this era of hyper-personalization, and I think the one place where we haven't yet seen that is in medicine. And so I think where we're going in the biotech field as it relates to medicine is a place where instead of what's the case today, If you were, for example, diagnosed with certain kinds of cancers, your doctor has four or five different cancer drugs to choose from. They don't really know which one you're going to react to the best. And so it's trial and error to see which one will get at your cancer the best. But what we're seeing now is that we can actually use DNA, and even some companies at University of Chicago starting to use tRNA to see and develop genetic profiles that, number one, enable us to look at your genetic profile and better predict which of those existing cancer drugs we should start with. But even more importantly, have these different genetic profiles on file, I guess you might say, so that we can develop 20 or 30 different cancer drugs that are tailored to various different genetic profiles, and so hopefully personalize your medical care to you. In that vein, another kind of personalized medical care development we're seeing is in the tools that we want to put in the hands of primary care physicians. So if you think about your regular primary care physician, your family doctor, who's not a specialist in anything, they're really good at spotting some things, but not good at others. They're not a specialist. So you may well have four or five different symptoms that if you went to an oncologist, they would say, oh, those are all signs of colon cancer. But your primary care physician doesn't really know and has no reason to know really that those things, when taken together, should lead to a referral to an oncologist. There's a lot of companies that are trying to develop AI-based tools that take data from a lot of different sources, pool it together, and enable a primary care physician at the point of practice to type in all your symptoms, and then the algorithm will spit out the sort of likelihood of whether you might have various diseases so that your primary care physician can earlier in your life figure out if they should be referring you, as opposed to when you start actually feeling stomach pains and then realize you have colon cancer and maybe it's too late to treat. And then the last area that I'm actually really excited about, and we have a lot of folks at U of C, including a company called Essia, that are working on this, is in dementia and Alzheimer's research. Up till now, a lot of our dementia and Alzheimer's care has focused on ameliorating the impact of your symptoms on both you and your family for as long as possible. Or once we know you have Alzheimer's and dementia, essentially palliative care, or trying to keep you mentally fit for as long as possible, but we've not been able to slow the progression and we've not been able to cure it. And now researchers are finding that perhaps we do know exactly what the cause of Alzheimer's is, and we can stop that before it starts. And that's really important because, as has been widely reported, we have a dramatically aging population. There are not as many young people being born. Their birth rate, the replacement rate, is stuck below two. And so our aging population is going to have to be more self-sufficient than they've been in the past. So to the extent that we can figure out some of these aging and mental puzzles as people get older, that's going to be critically important, I think, for us as a society.
Yeah, and it seems like there's a lot of critical work being done in the Midwest on the topic of biotech. And one of the things that you mentioned is DNA. And in the Bay Area and the Silicon Valley broadly, there is a sort of entrepreneurial DNA in a lot of folks who are, you know, from the scientists to the engineers to the lawyers. What does the culture of entrepreneurship at the University of Chicago Law School look like?
Yeah, this is a great question. And I suspect that many of your listeners, like you, are prospective law students. So I hope they all hear me when I say, if you want to be a tech lawyer, if you want to be a VC lawyer, if you want to even be an entrepreneur yourself, the West Coast schools are not the only place that you could do that. The University of Chicago Law School in particular has invested a lot in making sure that we are a great home for would-be entrepreneurs or lawyers who are representing entrepreneurs. And I'm really proud of what we've put together, particularly over the last few years. So if you think about like all the building blocks that one might have to build a law school that is great for entrepreneurship, obviously the first would be that traditional podium curriculum, right? And offerings for students who just want to enroll in a class and take the class. And we have tons of that. I mean, any class you could think of that's either general transactional law or entrepreneurship specific as it relates to the legal aspects of that, or even getting more granular into certain industries that you might want to take a class about. University of Chicago Law School offers all of that. So some of them taught by our full-time faculty, and others that we bring in as adjuncts who might be really interesting experts in the space who can offer a practitioner, a current practitioner's boots on the ground type of view to help our students really understand what's going on today. So that's kind of the podium side, right? And then we have my side of the faculty, which is the clinical side, the experiential side. So you can take clinics, and we have three different clinics at the University of Chicago that are not just transactional, but that also offer opportunities to get involved with entrepreneurship. So we have my clinic, and we'll talk about specifically the kind of work that my clinic does a little bit later. We also have the Institute for Justice Clinic on Entrepreneurship, and they focus more on representing local small businesses and low-income entrepreneurs, right? So you and I have been focusing more on the tech and the high-growth startup flavor of entrepreneur, but there's also the entrepreneur that just wants to open up a small business, a restaurant in Hyde Park where we're located. They don't really want to scale. And so we have different clinics at U of C Law that represent both of those different categories of entrepreneurs. And we also have a clinic called the Corporate Lab that focuses more on Fortune 500 clients, but they also do represent some campus startups and do a lot of tech work as well. We have other experiential offerings outside of our clinics. One of my favorite classes like this is led by Todd Henderson here at the law school and Will Gossin. It's called Hacking for Defense, and various contractors and departments of the Department of Defense come to present to the students problems that they have. And these problems range from everything from a lot of women leave the armed forces once they have children. Can you help us figure out how to make the armed forces a better employment opportunity for women that have families? All the way up to when we're out in space, we have no way of communicating with other countries to prevent collisions with our satellites because there's no secure communication channels. So how can we create a communication channel that allows for the exchange of non-secure information with astronauts from one country and the other? And so the students over the course of that class develop solutions to those DoD problems. And we have had students who end up not even becoming lawyers. They pursue those ideas full time and end up going to work for the companies that they founded as part of that class, which is pretty cool. And then there's also, you know, the typical more social elements of entrepreneurship at the law school. So you can join the Technology Law Society. You can join the Business Law Society. We have the Doctoroff Business Leadership Program with a generous gift from Dan Doctoroff that funds programming from the Booth School of Business, which is just a block away from us and is one of the best business schools in the country. They'll lead classes about business that are exclusive to this group of law students. So there's a lot of opportunities that the law school invests in for its students from pedagogical and experiential standpoint, as well as encouraging students to get involved. We call it across the midway. That just means in other divisions other than the law school. And then finally, we have one of my favorite things about being an alumnus of University of Chicago, in addition to being a teacher here now, is that we have a really involved and active and passionate alumni base. And a lot of people don't think of tech when they think of the University of Chicago Law School. So they would probably be surprised to learn that the people in the C-suite at big companies, and by C-suite, I mean, they're the chief executive officer or the general counsel, the chief operating officer. The people in the C-suite at companies like Apple, Cloudflare, Coinbase, two different former Facebook general counsels, the founders of a number of venture capital firms, including Trust Ventures in Austin, Sidewalk Labs, Tusk Ventures, the original chief operating officer of PayPal, and even the former chairman of the FCC, they are all University of Chicago alums. And I have personally seen each and every one of them come and interact with and speak with our students in the, you know, 4 years that I've been here. So they're excited that our students are excited about this area. And so if you're looking for a place to network with the best and the brightest in tech, University of Chicago Law School is a great place to do it.
Yeah, and it seems like there are so many opportunities at the University of Chicago Law School. And I think I was also wondering, and our viewers are also wondering, how about the University of Chicago more broadly?
Absolutely. So again, much like the law school, the University of Chicago more broadly, keenly focused on driving entrepreneurship and driving innovation. On campus, our hub for all things innovation and entrepreneurship is the Polsky Center. There's two components to that. So one side of the house is the Polsky Exchange. This is more focused on our small businesses and that kind of entrepreneurship rather than sort of innovators, and provides lots of resources for them, including lunch and learns, webinars, workspaces, things like that, to facilitate entrepreneurship by those in the community who may not otherwise have had access to entrepreneurship in their daily lives. And then at the Polsky Center for Entrepreneurship and Innovation, we're really trying to foster would-be campus founders, whether they are faculty members or whether they are current students in any division, and to make it easier for them and to encourage them to start new businesses that are groundbreaking and innovative. So on the faculty side, we have this great Office of Tech Transfer, and we create accelerator programs for them, like the Compass, which is for deep tech, Duality, which I mentioned, which is for quantum specifically. You know, one thing that you often see is that scientists are brilliant, but they don't have business experience because that's just not been what they've been expected to do in their careers. And so we do a lot at the Polsky Center, helping those kinds of founders to develop a business plan, do customer discovery, sort of understand how to talk to venture capitalists, understand how to talk to potential acquirers, really focusing on helping them build a company and an operating model around the product that they invented that no one else could invent. So the Polsky Center is really driving a lot of that here on campus. They also have frequent private and public educational sessions for founders that are open to the community. And then on the student side, many people have probably heard of the New Venture Challenge, which just celebrated its 25th anniversary. And so that's really more geared towards students, and it doesn't have to be in deep tech. It can be any kind of startup. So people familiar with Simple Mills, which is a rice-based food product company. That was a New Venture Challenge company. Tovala, which makes the sous vide food. That was a New Venture Challenge company. All the way up to Andy's STR, which was a winner a couple years ago, which does short-term property rental management. So that's an accelerator program that students who have a business idea can participate in. And then at the end of the program, there is a pitch day, and that's when they find out if they got funding. So yes, including because we have the Polsky Center, the Booth School of Business, which has really beefed up its entrepreneurship offerings over the last 5-10 years. I don't want to quote them because I may get this wrong, but it seems like they've had almost a one-to-one replacement rate with students who would have otherwise chosen to go into investment banking, now going into entrepreneurship instead. So yes, lots of robust entrepreneurship and innovation activity on campus outside of the law school, and not least of all in our deep tech and science-based organization.
Yeah, and it seems like there's so much help for both students in the law school and the business school to improve entrepreneurship at the university more broadly. And also the Innovation Clinic is there to really help folks and help startups succeed. So I was wondering, what was the inspiration behind the Innovation Clinic, and what type of companies does the Innovation Clinic work
with? The Innovation Clinic, like I said, does two different buckets of work. One is transactional and one is regulatory. On the transactional side, we pretty much do any kind of transactional work for any startup that we come across. So whether it's things like funding documents, entity formation, employee independent contractor matters, negotiating commercial agreements with new partners, we will do all of that. And so that's kind of a necessary part of being a startup lawyer, is that you can service those basic needs, those basic transactional needs of your clients. But that's not really the genesis of why this clinic came to be. So 7 or 8 years ago, a friend and former classmate of mine, Salen Shuri, had this light bulb moment when he was working for the Institute for Justice Clinic, that clinic was really good at servicing these low-income, small business-type entrepreneurs, but that high-growth startup innovators had different priorities and a different mindset from those small business owners that justified having a separate clinic to service them. And so from this really generous gift by Leslie Bloom and David Helfand, we were able to found the Innovation Clinic. And the Innovation Clinic's focus was really on the following problem. There are lots of really great, innovative, disruptive companies that can have really significant benefits to society, but there are current regulations that might prevent them from getting off the ground before they've even begun. So for example, if you think of Uber 20 years ago, taxi medallion regulations and regulations around who can drive who around the city would have prevented Uber from getting off the ground. Now, back then, you could do what Uber and Airbnb did, which is, you know, ask for forgiveness, not permission. So they have both really pursued this kind of aggressive regulatory strategy, which is to get the product in the hands of a lot of people, have a really loyal following, so that when you go interact with a regulator, you have this leverage to say, that's fine, you can get rid of me, but you're going to have a lot of unhappy constituents in your voting district. I think now regulators have wised up to that sort of a model. And so it's really important to get your regulatory strategy under lock and key ex ante before you go to market, so that you have buy-in from regulators. And that's really where the innovation clinic comes in. So for companies where there's a law that seems on its face to be a great idea, but it might impact a particular company that could do something really good for society negatively, we come in and help them to solve that regulatory problem. Sometimes that means that we are helping that company rethink how it does business so that it doesn't run afoul of that regulatory scheme at all. Other times it involves helping them figure out how they can liaise with regulators in order to change the laws that are impacting their businesses so that they can actually operate in the way that they want to.
Yeah, and it seems like you're really working with a lot of industries, from biotech to sports to consumer products to quantum computing. And in the process, you're overseeing both a lot of lawyers and technologists. So, Professor Underwood, how do you view collaborations and how technologists can work hand in hand with lawyers to ensure that our future disrupts, innovates, and embarks on changes in our future?
Yeah, so lawyers really can have a lot of roles in this space. One of the most obvious roles is as just a representative, right? On that basic transactional stuff that I mentioned, it's really easy for founders to make some mistakes on that stuff if they do it without a lawyer. And so at the most basic level, lawyers can just help, you know, these folks to kind of get out of their own way and avoid unintended negative consequences in terms of how they set up their company, how they set up their relationships among founding teams, and the like. But I think one of the most important roles that a lawyer can have is really as a translator between business teams and regulators for these disruptive companies. Regulators, and, you know, not to be unfair to regulators, I know lots of people who work at them and I have the utmost respect for them. So this is a broad generalization, but regulators, understandably so, because their priority is in protecting the public, have a tendency and an incentive to be very risk averse. It doesn't do a regulator much good to take a flyer on a disruptive company or give them an exemption from some rule that's designed to protect the public if then what happens is the public is ultimately harmed and turn around and says to the regulator, why did you let this happen to me? That can have the unfortunate result, as I mentioned earlier, that a lot of new products are dead in the water before they are even born. So probably the best example of this right now would be crypto, right? We definitely have more clarity now than we did 3 years ago in the crypto industry in terms of how the SEC and CFTC are thinking about how crypto should be regulated. Nevertheless, there's still not enough clarity for investors and for people who are creating new cryptocurrencies, people who are investing in cryptocurrencies. They really don't have enough of a firm foundation and precision and definitiveness in what the regulatory scheme around crypto looks like to be confident in that scheme. And so I think you see that that's definitely a huge contributing factor to the volatility that you see in crypto markets right now. I think that company Oklo that I mentioned earlier with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and the issues that they've had is probably another really good example of this. And so lawyers can uniquely help to bridge this gap, because when you go to law school, I hate to break it to all of your prospective law students that are listening to your podcast right now, but the unfortunate reality is you really don't learn how to practice law in terms of actually the boots on the ground, day-to-day experience of being a lawyer. But what you do learn is how to think like a lawyer. And one of the best skills that lawyers have is that they can listen to the concerns and the priorities of people on two different sides of a debate. And hopefully, if they're good at their job, which I like to think everyone who went to U of C is pretty good at their job, but if they're good at their job, they can help to find the common ground and design creative solutions that really speak to the concerns of each party and hopefully get them both to a place where they're happy. You also learn how to think five or six steps ahead, right? So a lot of times when a founder is really excited, they want to embark on a certain course of action and they do it. And then something bad happens that they didn't anticipate. Lawyers are really good at thinking ahead to what are all the parade of horribles that could happen, right? Like that's a part of the reason, frankly, why people don't like lawyers a lot. We do, for better or worse, tend to pour some cold water on some hot ideas. But at the end of the day, that's a good thing because you as a founder want to be able to anticipate what those five, six, seven unintended consequences, potential pathways from the nucleus point might be so that you're ready to respond to them if and when they come up. And I think it was Dwight Eisenhower who once said, plans are nothing, but planning is everything. That's really what lawyers are good at. If you have thought about all of the potential permutations of what can happen, then you're probably going to be better off even if you don't follow your initial plan than somebody who didn't do that exercise. So I think that lawyers can be really good as that go-between and that facilitator. And so I think what they should do is help companies avoid pitfalls and other than that, kind of stay out of the way.
Yeah, so lawyers do have a big role in the ecosystem of startups and entrepreneurship. And technology's influence on the law isn't just confined to those big law firms. It's seen in most corporate legal departments where they're both managed by lawyers who spend a ton of time and a ton of years doing administrative things like billing, but not really using it for delivering it for their legal services. And in my view, technology is needed for a lot of these legal delivery processes, entering a sort of brave new world. What are your thoughts on the idea that technology is automating away the legal industry, according to a recent MIT study?
Yeah, love this question. And it's really funny that you ask because my students and I actually had the great honor of posing this question to a panel of experts earlier this year. So we were super lucky, just as an aside. We got a gift from Douglas Clark, who's the managing partner of Wilson Sonsini, which is one of the biggest law firms in the tech and venture capital space. He's also alumnus of the law school. And he gave us, wrote a check to us so that I could take my students in the innovation clinic to a trek to Silicon Valley to really immerse them in the tech and venture capital ecosystem there over spring break. And we had tons of great panels with tons of experts in awesome industries that we may not have had access to otherwise. And one of the panels that we had was about legal tech industry. And we asked the folks on that panel, are we all going to be out of a job pretty soon? Because AI and legal tech are taking over. And one of the people on that panel was actually a law school classmate of mine, Kimball Parker. So hi, Kimball, if you're listening. And he founded 650. And 650 is an amazing service that automates a lot of low-level legal documents. They're actually a subsidiary of Wilson Sonsini now. And so he had an answer to this question that I just thought was so perfect. So Kimball, if you're listening, I'm stealing your quote, but I'm attributing it to you. And Kimball said that his view on this, which I 100% agree with, is that automation, AI, and legal technology will threaten your job as a lawyer if you are a lawyer who makes light bulbs. But if you're a lawyer who makes chandeliers, we always need lawyers who make chandeliers. And what he means by that is if you're the kind of lawyer who does work that is very commoditized and doesn't vary a lot across different companies or types of clients. So for example, really basic privacy law compliance, garden variety employment work, potentially even some kinds of immigration and asylum filings. That's the kind of work that it's pretty easy to supplant with AI-based tools. And it's important for people to keep in mind, like AI is just the automation of knowledge, right? So if you think about the wisdom of crowds, people often, there's been a lot of studies that show that if you get one answer from your best friend and 20 different answers from 20 strangers, and then sort of synthesize the average answer from those 20 people, almost everyone prefers the answer they got from 20 strangers than the one best friend. And that's kind of the idea behind AI. It just takes all of the data that we have about what's the best way to proceed and then predicts or recommends a course of action based on all that knowledge that it's automated. And so if you are the kind of lawyer whose job is largely a function of getting a lot of knowledge and then actioning directly that knowledge without a ton of regard to the idiosyncrasies that might result from different clients, or rather, not that the lawyer doesn't appreciate the idiosyncrasies, but rather the nature of the practice is such that there's simply not that many idiosyncrasies to worry about. That's what AI is going to do away with. But if you're building chandeliers, by which I mean you're working on a transaction like an M&A deal or a capital markets deal that has a lot of really complicated, unique, never before seen features to it. Or if you are doing a kind of litigation that's impact litigation, a question that no court has ever answered, that's going to go all the way up to the Supreme Court. Basically, the kinds of things that aren't subject to a pattern or break the mold or are out of the ordinary in any way, AI and legal tech are uniquely bad at helping you do that kind of work, because if there's no past data that can help you predict what to do, the AI is pretty useless. And so that's the kind of legal role that won't go away. Now, there's other kinds of tools, right, that actually, to your point about this whole admin backend, you know, lawyers hate tracking their time. One of my favorite things about my job right now is that I never have to keep track of my billable hours, and it has really made a difference. But there are other kinds of legal tech that can make the practice of law more frictionless for the people who are actually doing it. So technology that helps you better track your hours, technology that helps you find certain types of provisions in a document faster, technology that helps you organize and analyze contractual provisions faster so that you can do more of that in a day, like products like Lawgood or Lexion, those I think won't do away with lawyer jobs, but they'll enable less lawyers to do more work, thereby freeing up some lawyers who potentially have more experience or better experience to do this better, more complicated work.
Well, it seems like lawyers will be here to stay, and they'll continue working with a lot of the technologists of the future. So I want to thank you again for having this wonderful conversation. And do you have anything else to say, Professor?
Not at all. I really encourage anyone who's listening, whether you're a prospective law student or just somebody who's interested in what we're doing at University of Chicago more generally, you can reach out to me. My email is publicly available on the University of Chicago Law School's website. And Ken, thank you so much for having me today. And your homework that I'm assigning you as a professor is to go have a top dog in my honor after we hop off this call.
And I'll be at Top Dog right after this call. And thank you so much, everybody, for listening to this episode of The Robots Are Coming. And next time, we'll have more professors speaking on the topics of startups, policy, and entrepreneurship. So make sure you subscribe to The Robots Are Coming wherever you're listening to, and tell all of your friends and buddies to do that as well. Thank you so much.